Good evening and welcome. I think it's time to get started. I do believe a few students will come straggling in. I am so delighted to see students, faculty, community members here, and I've actually wanted this day to happen for several years, and Mary Helen and I have been in conversation over the last three or four trying to figure out a day or a couple of days when she could come to campus. Before I formally introduce Dr. Mary Helen Washington, I want to cover just a few announcements. She will be speaking tomorrow in chapel at 10 a.m. in Lehman Auditorium, and I invite you all to join us for that if you are able. The title of tomorrow morning's talk is Swept Away, an Adventure Tale for Millennials. After her lecture tonight, there'll be a short time of question and answers, and we'll have a microphone that can move around the room. So if you have a question, feel free to ask it. And if you're interested in buying one of her books, they're available, and she would be glad to sign it for you. And there'll be hot drinks and some really good cookies and brownies as well after we're finished. I first met Mary Helen Washington in 1990 when she moved into the house across the street from us in our Silver Spring neighborhood. I had heard about her previously from a student of mine at the University of Maryland who was not happy about the grade she received from one of her professors. This professor of African American literature had given her feedback about how her paper did not quite meet course expectations. Needless to say, this was only the beginning for me of my understanding of how Mary Helen not only sets high expectations for her students, but also for herself. She has a serious work philosophy, which she calls BTS, butt to seat. No excuses. And for the past almost 15 years, I've watched her embody this as she has worked on the book from which she will talk tonight. This book, The Other Blacklist, The African American Literary and Cultural Left of the 1950s. Mary Helen was born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio. From 1975, when she was appointed director of Black Studies at the University of Detroit, she has studied, taught, and written about African-American literature. In addition to the University of Detroit, she's taught at St. John College of Cleveland, Harvard University, Wellesley, Mills College, the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and she is currently professor of English at the University of Maryland in College Park. She's been a mentor to me. She's my go-to person for books to read. She first introduced me to the narratives of Black women in this book, Invented Lives. She has helped me look for and see, not only with my eyes, but also with my heart, the ways in which racism and sexism continue to present themselves all around us. She has sustained a commitment over her lifetime to restore narratives that were once forgotten, hidden, lost, or told with serious censoring. Tonight, Mary Helen's presentation is titled Visualizing Blackness, Charles White, Race, and the Communist Party. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Mary Helen Washington.
Thank you, Deanna. Always nice to be introduced by someone who actually knows you and to feel, yes, that is me. You should have in your hands at this point a handout. Teachers, hard to come anywhere without a handout. This was supposed to be a collage of all of the covers that have had Charles White art on them. I wasn't able to do that, so what you actually have in your hand are some small prints of the art that I'm going to show here on the wall. Now, the reason for that is I wanted to show all of these covers as a way of proving how popular Charles White has been over the years. He has appeared on the covers of probably 100 books. And if you watch The Cosby Show very, very carefully, you may have seen his art on the walls of the living room of that family. I chose this chapter out of The Other Blacklist, decided that the person I wanted to focus on is Charles White in this talk. And I chose this to focus on White for three reasons. He was an artist on the left in the 1950s, in the McCarthy era, when it was actually dangerous to be a radical. Second, I wanted to correct some of the assumptions about the influence of the Communist Party on black artists and writers. And I understand that that word, communist, can leave people a little shaken, so I really wanted to confront what that meant for these artists and writers to be so close to the party during the time that they were working in the 1950s. I also wanted to propose my own alternative history of black artists and writers of the 1950s and to correct some of the evasions and misconceptions about that period. Often we think of the 1950s as a period of great conservatism, and truly it was. But in the midst of that conservatism, there was this really strong body of radical work being done. And then I also wanted you to engage in and be engaged by the disturbing and complex beauty of White's art. Finally, in my conclusion, I want to point out some ways in which I think White's art is relevant for a contemporary moment. All right, let me begin by clarifying some terms. I will use the term communist in this talk very guardedly, as I did in my book. And that is only when I am trying to indicate, or when I am indicating, that a person or an institution was officially and publicly a part of the Communist Party. Most of the writers and artists in my book were close to, influenced by, aligned with, but rarely actually an official member of the party. More often, I use the term left or progressive for people whose politics during this period were closely allied to the Communist Party, but were not necessarily in the party. The second term I'm going to be using is Black Popular Front. And by that, it's a term that's modeled on the Popular Front of the 1930s, and it can be described as a loosely organized coalition of artists, writers, and other cultural workers, trade unionists, and activists who were on the left during the 1950s. The Popular Front included everything from communists to fellow travelers to liberals who supported the radical aims of the left to people who opposed racism, fascism, anti-communism. This is not a kind of officially put together group, but a band of people who had the same kind of radical aims and views. I have extended the period of the Black Popular Front to the 1950s, partly because the artists in this study had continued to work in these popular front-style organizations during that period when, as I say, radicalism was actually quite dangerous. If you know anything about the Black Popular Front, you would know that throughout World War II and after, they led labor struggles, they fought for black jobs in war production and in unions, they fought for fair employment practices, they kept watch on all the events that were unfolding as Asian and African states gained independence. I mean, this is part of the radical agenda that they were part of. Beyond the war, they tried to internationalize black struggle with petitions to the United Nations, one of which was called We Charge Genocide, a powerful critique of the institutional racism in America and their effort to internationalize black struggle. You understand, what I'm trying to do is to give you a little background on how you put, where you put white, and in what context do we understand this art. From the 1930s to the 1950s, Charles White was a part of these black popular front collectives, both in Chicago and in New York. He wrote for, and I'm going to name some of the activities that he was involved in, because most of the critical studies about Charles White and about the other writers in my book either evade, eliminate, or minimize the left connections of these writers. And they minimize them because communism has been so demonized since the 1950s. But his left reputation, his left affiliations are so important that you will not be able to understand the art that I'm going to show you without understanding those contexts. He wrote for and illustrated a Marxist publication, The Masses and Mainstream and New Masses. He wrote for and illustrated the actual communist paper, The Daily Worker, all of which helped to nurture both his political life as well as his aesthetic formation. And you will watch that this is the theme of my talk. Here's this political artist also trying to make changes in black cultural representations. You can't separate those two sides of this writer. Along with his first wife, the renowned sculptor and artist Elizabeth Catlett, he taught classes at the Abraham Lincoln School in Chicago, a communist-led school. He taught at the left-wing George Washington Carver School for people, working people in Harlem. His international travels included Mexico, where he studied art with the Mexican communist artists Diego Rivera, David Siqueiros, and Jose Orozco. He traveled to the Soviet Union and Germany, both of which helped to establish his international reputation. In fact, the first major critical study of White's work was done by a communist critic, Sidney Finkelstein, and was published in Germany by a socialist publisher. His major art exhibitions in the United States in the 1940s and the 1950s were at a gallery, the American Contemporary Art Gallery in New York, a left-wing gallery run by a left-wing director, Herman Baron. He met his second wife, the social worker Frances Barrett, at a left-wing camp for children, Camp Wochika, that's short for Workers Children's Camp, where she was a counselor and he taught art. And when they moved to New York in the 1950s, he and his wife, Fran, were active members of one of the most important and influential black popular front organizations in New York called the Committee for the Negro in the Arts. And I just would like to note that people like Sidney Poitier, Ruby Dee, Ossie Davis, Harry Belafonte, W.E.B. Du Bois, all were a part of the Committee for the Negro in the Arts. And probably that is the most important black popular front organization of the 1950s. They worked very hard to address the issue of black exclusion from television, from print, from publication, from publishing, and had some success at that. One of the reasons I emphasize White's strong connections to the left is to underscore that he was working in the 1940s and 1950s when stereotypes of black Americans were an accepted part of the culture and black artists were not. So much of his work was made possible by those left affiliations. Even as a young art student, though, in Chicago in the 1930s, White was already intent on making art that would be accessible to working class communities and on creating what I'm calling his new black aesthetic. During more than 40 years as an artist, he created a visual archive of more than 500 images of black Americans and black American history and culture. His portrait of historical figures included Frederick Douglass, John Brown, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Leadbelly, and Paul Robeson, which have become signatures of his artistic legacy. Now, pay attention to that list of figures that he represents in his work in the 40s and 50s. This is before Black studies. This is before Black nationalism. This is before the civil rights movement. So what would have encouraged and supported a writer and artist doing this kind of work? He produced great murals such as The Contribution of the Negro to Democracy in America, 1943. Another one called A History of the Negro Press. Another called Five Great American Negroes. Again, all of this is 39 to 1943, and they became immediately recognizable as White's signature. He developed a highly respected reputation in both Black and white working class communities because he worked very hard to make his art accessible, financially as well as aesthetically, especially to working class people. And in the 1950s, in the early 1950s, he actually published six prints in what he called a folio. And the folio was published by Masses and Mainstream, a left-wing press, and he sold them, the six prints, for about $1.50. In fact, I bought one in New York for, I think, about $10. I'll tell you how much that's worth later. In the 1960s, again, trying to make his art accessible, he contracted with the Black-owned Golden State Mutual Insurance Company of Los Angeles to illustrate their calendars in order to ensure that his art would be found in Black homes, restaurants, barbershops, beauty shops, and places where Black working-class people would see it. Some say that he did more than any other artist of his generation to put art in the hands of Black and white working class people. And just in case you might have one of those prints or calendars, or you might one day come across one of those calendars and prints, they are no longer available at working class prices and now range in price from $6,000 to $300,000. White was deeply embedded in this political context. And as I want to continue to reiterate, we can't separate the cultural aesthetic that he forms, especially in the 1940s and 50s, from his political affiliations. He is very much in line now with Communist Party politics. And when I say he's in line with the politics, I'm not putting him in the party. But in 1928, the Communist Party began to give special attention to Black culture, then called, of course, Negro culture, publishing an initiative that was known as the Black Belt Thesis, which insisted that African-American culture, as a representation of the proletariat, should be encouraged, celebrated, and supported. So when White focuses on these great historical figures from Black history in his murals, and when he chooses to depict the everyday, ordinary, working-class people, he was fully aligned with the goals and objectives of the Communist Party. Describing White's new cultural aesthetic, one artist described it this way: "The people Charlie wants to bring to life are proudly and unabashedly Black folk, Africans, with thick lips and broad nostrils. Here are no Caucasian features in blackface, but proud Blacks, bigger than life in epic and heroic proportions. Here are the most African-looking, the poorest, and the Blackest people in our ranks, the ones who, by all accounts, are the furthest from the country's white standards of success and beauty." White never wavered from that commitment. Another friend of his, another artist friend of his, says that he was an artist with a strong social consciousness, a committed anti-fascist whose art was always aimed against the oppression of his people. What I have tried to do throughout the other blacklists is to document the importance of White's long association with progressive and left-wing groups to show that he was fully involved with movements for racial and social justice and that he saw his art and politics as inseparable. My conclusion in the White chapter is actually meant partly for the critics of Charles White, who have over the past 20 years either minimized or ignored his life on the left. One could actually conclude at the end of studying his life during this period that the critics that reviewed his work, the galleries that showed his work, the publishers who published his work, and the major biographers and critics commenting on his work were all left-identified and nearly all aligned with the Communist Party. In a testimony to White's dedication to progressive movements and to art and culture in service to a black working class, the novelist John Killens paid him a high compliment, calling him, quote, Paul Robeson with a brush and pencil. So what I want to do in the remainder of my talk tonight is to focus closely on several of White's drawings in order to reconnect his work to their original political and cultural context. And I want to speculate on how White's art helps us to understand what one critic called race radicalism. And I also want to bring him up to date, and I want to speculate on how we would look at issues like multiculturalism differently if we looked at them through the lens of the kind of work that White was doing in the 1950s. And so I want you to just follow with me as I read the art that I have to show to you tonight. The first of these, now make sure that this is all working. Ah, yes, it is working. Okay. So you also have these on the sheet that you have in your hand. They're very small. I think you can certainly see them much better here. But I'm going to go through about six of his pieces that I have here, starting with this one, which was one of his large murals. He actually did in 1940 three large murals. This is the first of them. This is called A History of the Negro Press. It was commissioned by the Associated Negro Press, and it was to represent a visual chronicle of the 100-year-old history of the black press. He actually won first prize for this mural in 1940 when he was just 26 years old. It was displayed in the offices of the Chicago Defender for many years and then was lost or destroyed, as many of his pieces have been destroyed. So reading this, the mural features 11 male figures engaged in the production of black newspapers. In the center of the left half of the mural are the three titans of the black press: John Russworm, the founder of the first black newspaper in 1827, Freedom's Journal. He holds a series of broadsides spread out before him. Let's see if this little thing will work. Huh? Yes. Okay, so right at the center is Russworm. Above him and to his left is Frederick Douglass, the founder of the 1847 abolitionist paper, The North Star. There he is with a full head of white hair and a beard, and his arm is around a former slave. Centered at the apex of this triumvirate to Douglass's right, okay, right there with his professorial black-rimmed glasses, vest, and tie is T. Thomas Fortune, the editor of the militant New York Age, founded in the early 1880s. At the bottom left is a man reading the paper, and another one with a torch. See if I can find that. Not sure where the torch actually is. But it's a torch. There it is, right there. that white often used to represent militant struggle. We'll also see that again in the painting of Sojourner Truth. The four figures on the right side of the mural represent the contemporary press. One man in a reporter's trench coat, his press pass tucked into the rim of his hat, takes notes. To his right, a photographer holds a flashbulb camera, and to his left is the operator of the printing press standing next to a machine that spins out the news of the day. That mural is balanced with a man setting type on the far left, the modern printing press on the right half. In this early work, we see White's investment in showing African-American culture as part of modernity. And that modernity is clearly on display in the way the drawing represents the relationship between the men and the machines. There are 11 men in this mural, calmly poised before, in control of, and helping to produce the forces of modernity unleashed by the machines. One must read the Popular Front politics in this mural, which emphasizes the role of African-American entrepreneurial struggle in the making of a more democratic America. I call your attention to the fact that this is 1940, and it is only people on the left that were producing art like this, and art with the intention of saying Black people, African-American culture, are at the forefront of a democratic United States. All right, so that's the first mural. This one I actually have on the sheet on the third page because I wanted you to be able to see that one in full. So White is producing these murals, and this one is called Techniques Used in the Service of the Struggle. And again, this is another one that has been lost. In this third mural, we see White following the example of the Mexican muralist that he eventually studies under, and that all the people that were on the Black Popular Front in the New York and Chicago areas all either studied the Mexican muralists or actually went to Mexico to study under them, and those people were definitely communists. But we see him following the example of the Mexican muralists and some of the other WPA artists trying to combine formal experimentation with a vision of Black national struggle. In contrast to the progressive motion in the history of the Negro press, this mural depicts Black struggle checked by racist brutality. In fact, this mural had several names. It was sometimes called the Chaos of Negro Life. It was sometimes, White called it the Revolt of the Negro During Slavery, and eventually he settled on Techniques Used in the Service of the Struggle. I think these conflicting titles reflect the way viewers used to a more Pacific style. And if you look at a lot of the WPA murals, you will not see anything like this. The WPA murals try to represent an America of peace, progress, prosperity, rarely included people of color, never included racial strife, and people may simply have been unsettled by this raw depiction of racial violence. All right, the 13 figures in this panel constitute a historical tableau of Black subjugation and Black resistance to slavery, peonage, sharecropping, and lynching. On the far right side of the panel, a Black man, right there, is bent almost over to his knees, held in shackles and chains by a white overseer. The only figures that are actually separated from the other figures. All the other figures are intertwined. Slightly right of center, there is a lynched body hanging from a tree that surrealistically comes up out of the ground and is blasted off at the top, with its one branch curved around to the hanged man's neck as if it has gone in search of him. In the center of the mural, as in several of White's murals, there is a Black family, a woman holding a child, right there. Next to them, the man of the family looking back in anguish at the woman, his arms stretched out in front of him. Next to him is the enlarged head of John Brown. And remember, John Brown is one of those popular front figures that was used by the left to signal the struggle of the whites to support black militancy. His head almost seems to be decapitated and looming out of history, disconnected from his foreshortened arm, which holds a rifle and is intertwined with the hand of the black father. So there they are. On the left side of the mural are figures that continue the theme of black resistance. There's a man with a guitar standing next to the iron bars of a jail cell who might suggest the folk singer Leadbelly, another black popular front figure. And there's a man holding up a book right there, okay, a signature image that white used to represent the power of literacy and education. At the very top of this triangular composition, there's a man, I don't know, perhaps a preacher, holding an open book, looking down angrily on two men who are turned toward each other with a questioning and skeptical look, as if dismissing the illusions of religion. The overall narrative depicted in the intertwined and intersecting bodies is that black progress has been blocked by the forces of racism. That in the face of massive racial violence, despite the techniques of struggle, there is no exit. That's a tough picture. What makes White's mural here exceptional is the place that white accords black people and black resistance in the narrative and its unrelenting representation of racist brutality. Even though in 1940 white had not yet traveled to Mexico, techniques demonstrates that the Mexican muralists focused on political and social justice, on indigenous people, and on formal experimentation are all available here in this picture. Not only were the Mexican artists using their fight for the same progressive and radical values as artists in white circle against poverty, racism, and exploitation, but also in their visions of a future, they featured indigenous people in prominent and powerful positions. The Mexican influence is especially evident in all of White's 1949 drawings, which are more overtly political and stylistically more daring than any of his other work. And I'm leading up to the 49 pieces that were in a 1950 exhibition at the Left Wing ACA Gallery. And they include portraits of historical figures, John Brown, Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, and Harriet Tubman, and three historical drawings that I want to draw your attention to: the Ingram case, the Trenton Six, and Frederick Douglass Lives Again. And I'm just going to show you very quickly the three that I'm not going to talk about in any detail. This is his Harriet Tubman. This is my favorite. This is Sojourner Truth, as you've never seen her before. And you'll see some of the distinctive white qualities here. Wrong. Back. No, I don't know where I am. Okay, let's see. This is back. I wanted to go back to truth right there. To point out that signature piece that he has, some kind of whip or I'm not sure. Maybe you can help me with describing it. The enlarged and very elegiac quality around the eyes, and always the enlarged hands that are in the shape of a mallet. And, you know, when I go back, I'll talk again about some of the critics who did not like this representation of Sojourner Truth because it was too angry. The two pieces that I want to talk about, the first, are the Ingram case and the Trenton case, both of which were civil rights causes that were supported by the left-wing Civil Rights Congress. You know, when we talk about civil rights, we think 1950s, we think Martin Luther King, we do not think 1940s and the Civil Rights Congress, because it was too closely aligned with the left. The first one is Rosalie Ingram, and the story of Rosalie, let's see if I can find her on it. There it is, okay. She was a widow, a tenant farmer, mother of 14 children. Two of her sons were sentenced to death in Georgia in 1948 for the murder of their white tenant farm owner, who she claimed had sexually assaulted her. In White's drawing, Rosa and her two sons are behind massive bars, with Rosa looking out beyond the jail cell and her sons looking towards her. Hands are prominent in this drawing. One son clutches the bars with both hands, but Rosa's hand reaches beyond the bars and is balled into a fist. Her other hand lightly touches the bar, and both arms, as you will see, are enlarged. And the hands again like a mallet. The shadings of black and white on their faces emphasize both their blackness and their suffering. And the light from Rosa's eyes suggests grief and weariness. The bars seem to be holding them in the cell and weighing them down. But the swirling black and white lines of the mother's dress and her fists on the bars undercut the painting's sense of desperateness and suggest the tenaciousness of Rosa Ingram's fight to free herself and her sons. In response to public opinion about their harsh sentences, the Ingram sentence was later changed to life imprisonment, and then civil rights groups from the Urban League to the left-wing Sojourners for Truth and Justice fought to free Ingram, and largely because of the effort of the Civil Rights Congress, they were eventually freed in 1959. And again, I want to suggest something with these two paintings of the kind of work that the kind of cultural work that White was doing in his art, and the way he was trying to combine this new black cultural aesthetic with his political vision. In this one, this is the Trenton Six. White features the six men who were accused of killing a white man in Trenton, New Jersey, and sentenced to the electric chair despite a lack of evidence and proof. And proof that there was actually a frame-up and coerced confessions. 13 years after the near lynching of the 9 Scottsboro men, the same anti-black mob violence prevailed in the northeastern city of Trenton. After the widow of the murdered man named black men as the killers, the New Jersey Evening Times carried an editorial entitled, quote, "The Idle Death Chair," as if black suspects automatically required putting the chair to use. Because of the efforts of the CRC and Bessie Mitchell, and that is Bessie Mitchell is the sister of one of the framed men, the sentences were reversed by the Supreme Court. Let's see, that's Mitchell. And in a second trial, 4 of the 6 men were actually found innocent. In the midst of her fight to free her relatives, when Bessie Mitchell was asked why she turned to a group as controversial as the Communist Party, she replied, quote, "God knows we couldn't be no worse off than we are now." In the White drawing, Mitchell is the central figure standing in front of a barbed wire fence that encloses the 6 men, her enlarged hands and massive arms in a gesture of protectiveness, power, and pleading. One hand points to the men behind the fence, allowing the reader to move past Bessie to the men who face outward at nothing in particular, as though acknowledging the desperation of their situation. Bessie's eyes are sad but determined, gazing upward as though she is capable of doing whatever is necessary to free her kinsmen. However conservative these techniques may have seemed to a 1950s mainstream art critics that were smitten by abstraction, they represent the black avant-garde, since these techniques, the cubist, the enlarged hands, employed in the service of black resistance and on behalf of left-wing causes, combined images of white oppression, black anger, and leftist political work that would have constituted an assault on the national imaginary of Jim Crow America. In Sojourner Truth, Oh, you know, I haven't said much about this one. This is called Frederick Douglass Lives Again, and it certainly is in the same mode. It was in the same 1949 show at the ACA Gallery. And, of course, you see Douglass here in a large figure. You see the hand like a mallet up there again. And you see it's shortened, but it's extended out over all these people who are now breaking down these barbed wires because of his strength. Douglass is there looking like an Old Testament prophet, the mallet of the hand. This is also one of my favorites there. In both this one and The Sojourner Truth, you see him using this cubist influence in the enlarged hands, that seem sculpted into blocks of wood. You see the hands curved in the direction of the viewer. This is the Sojourner Truth one. Is it going to come up? Nope. It's not going to go back. Yes. You see the right hand curved in the direction of the viewer as if warning or in self-protection. Her left hand is raised, carrying that torch or that whip. Both hands shaped like wooden mallets. Here, White depicts Truth as an enigmatic figure who actually might be either male or female. Her face seems to emerge from her draped robe, making her seem mythical and mysterious, like an avenging Old Testament prophet. Same thing, I think, with Frederick Douglass. The look on her face is elegiac. The eyes are large, stern, and sad. Writing in 1951, one critic found this image unacceptable because of what he saw as its unreadability. He called this Cubist-style figure unapproachable, mystical, godlike, and ironically, that, of course, is the source of the paint of the drawing's power. I want to end by describing a Charles White lithograph that appears in a 1990 high school textbook called Multicultural Perspectives. It is also the painting that I chose for the cover of The Other Blacklist. Now let's see where I am with my... Okay, we've done Rosa and Bessie, Fred. This is one that he used to dramatize the fight in Texas over integrating a Texas law school. This one, I should comment on this one because it was the poster for a convention that was in Cleveland. And in my introduction, this is the one that I talk about. This was a convention of the National Negro Labor Council, again, a left-wing labor group that fought very hard for black rights in unions and against all forms of discrimination in labor. They held their second convention in Cleveland, and Charles White did the cover for this poster, and you see the Statue of Liberty dramatized as a black woman. And you see all of White's signature styles around the Statue of Liberty. I say in the introduction that when White and the Labor Council were meeting in Cleveland, I was about 20 blocks away in a Catholic grade school learning that the communists meant us no good. And one of the things that they did at the conclusion of this conference is that they massed a protest downtown against the airlines. You know, at that time in the 50s, airlines had their headquarters in downtown Cleveland, and they massed a huge protest against the airline industry for its discrimination against black people in hiring. All right, let's see where I am with these. Okay, I'm going to skip. I might go back to that. All right, so this is the cover of my book, and as I say, it's also featured in Multicultural Perspectives. Now, I hope you can imagine what I'm about to say. This is entitled by White, walk together. In the multicultural textbook, the drawing has been cropped so that only three figures remain. And so they cropped this drawing so that these are the only three figures in the drawing. Okay, so one, two, and three are in the multicultural textbook. And the rest of these people are all cut off, so it's cropped right there. And of course, three of the four figures that are missing from the textbook are the three women that are in the painting. One of the three men in the foreground is dressed to emphasize that he is a worker. That's a keeping with the story in the textbook. It's in keeping with the story in the textbook about Southern sharecroppers. You also have the man behind him on either side of him, the man with his hand on his shoulder. The effect of the picture, the cropped picture in the textbook, is portraiture. These three men could be on their way home from work, or they could be three friends walking together, but there's no social, or historical, or political context beyond the portrait of three serious, silent, and determined men standing together. In the original charcoal drawing, which was first printed in the Left Wing Masses and Mainstream in 1953 and called Let's Walk Together, there are these seven figures, not three, and all of the women are there occupying the center of the picture. Standing next to and holding the man, the arm of the man in the foreground, is a quite prominent woman who could be her husband, lover, relative, friend, colleague. Together with the other three figures behind and to the side of the couple, the group appears to comprise a community. But as they are all nearly the same age, they probably are not a family. What has deliberately been excised from the crop picture is a sense of a collective, a community and solidarity. Three people might be out on a stroll, but probably not seven. The seven are clearly united for some kind of purpose. They are clearly connected to one another by some kind of bonds, perhaps of affection or trust or race. Though the drawing was used in leftist publications, and they did use this in several leftist publications to signify a protest and to signify black unity, actually nothing in the drawing confirms the relationship of the seven people. Is this an informal gathering? Is this a family? Is this a union? Nothing gives evidence that they are even actually walking. While White shows off his elegant draftsmanship and the hauntingly beautiful faces of these seven black people, he ensured that the purpose of this gathering would not be easily accessible. The young man in the foreground left is dressed in a worker's jacket, pants, and a cap. And because he is front and center, he appears to be the main figure. But the main figure of what? The matronly woman on his left is dressed more formally, has her hand on his arm, and an older man, the one directly engaging the viewer, rests his hand on the young man's shoulder as if in some kind of support. One critic suggested that the older man is the figure of the folk singer Leadbelly, which then might be White's coded gesture of an affiliation with the left. Two of the men are wearing hats and appear to be workers, but the women's dresses are softer, of more delicate material that might be appropriate for a church event. All look expectant but uncertain, as if tamping down any unwarranted optimism. But optimism about what? Only one figure, the middle-aged man on the far left with his hand on the shoulder of the young man, right there, is the only one who looks directly at the viewer. But his expression is skeptical, as if to challenge, again, any attempt to decipher the drawing's meaning. Five of the figures are facing forward, their eyes focused down and slightly away from the viewer, so they do not visually engage us. The woman on the far right faces away from the viewer and toward the group with a slightly enigmatic smile, further reinforcing the sense of intimacy and privacy of the group, leaving the viewer to speculate on what, other than their racial identity, might constitute the group's unity. Novelist John Killen suggested that there was a prophetic meaning in this drawing. He says, quote, "Walk Together would appear to prophesy the heroism of Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King and 50,000 black folk who walked together hand in hand in the Montgomery bus boycott, some 3 or 4 years ahead of the time it happened. What's important here is that the drawing invites multiple interpretations, superseding even the insistence of leftist critics that the meaning had to be clear and unambiguous, and ultimately the drawing reveals only subversively. It reveals whites' continuing modernist inclinations toward not revealing. It seems more than accidental that this Charles White drawing is included in the multicultural textbook under Celebrating Heritage. Yet there were 3 other sections in the multicultural textbook. One was Opposing Injustice, one was Exploring Cultural Conflicts, one was Affirming Identity. They chose Celebrating Heritage. And yet all of Charles White's art responds to those issues, and in fact was crafted out of the need to respond to issues like opposing injustice, exploring cultural conflicts. The question I always ask about our ideas of multiculturalism is, how does it deal with questions of institutional racism and injustice? How does it make us aware of racial dominance and uneven social material relations? The artists on the left of the Other Black List constitute such a tradition of race radicalism, of profoundly anti-racist cultural work that represents a desire for something better than U.S. multiculturalism. They gave us a vocabulary, for one thing, with words like the collective, the community, white supremacy, the working class, the worker, colonialism, capitalism. And in the process, they, like White, countered the conservative integrationist narratives of the 1950s that reinforced rather than subverted white supremacy. They were able to do so because their art and activism was rooted in the militant discourses of the 1940s civil rights movement and in the values of the left that gave priority to a vision that emphasized class consciousness and the struggle against economic racism. Whether they were ambivalent communists, reluctant radicals, wary fellow travelers, or committed leftists, they linked themselves to the passion and power of a radical vision and a radical activism. Their work was animated by and enabled by a vision that refused the terms of liberalism promoted by the U.S. mainstream. They critiqued the left, even as they believed in many of its goals. In the end, they were, on their own terms, artists on the left, experimenters and protesters in both their activism and their art. And in the process, they introduced us to works of extraordinary but disturbing beauty. Thank you. And I'll be very happy to answer a few questions. Yes?
Was really drawn to the hands, the depiction of the hands, mm-hmm. especially in the large photo that you had. And I wonder if you can talk a little more, was there any more symbolism behind the way he chose to draw hands in particular?
Well, you know, I think the main thing is that, first of all, he does it in almost every single one of his 1940s and early 1950s drawings. Does it for women and for men. And I think without exception, it was always there to indicate strength, but also to indicate a kind of resistance. And I think it's also one of the ways in which he continue to work in modernist directions. So he tried to work against this kind of naturalized figure. And I think these kind of enlarged hands and arms were there really as a kind of dramatic way to say something about the ferocity of the resistance. I mean, for example, this is called Harvest Talk. And, you can see very clearly that this man's arm is significantly enlarged. Not so much this one, well, that one too, but this one. And, you know, this was a... Was it still on? This was the original figure for that drawing. And actually, this man's arm is really quite powerful and large, right? And this picture is called Waiting for the Bosses. And it was in a 1943 book called 12 Million Black Voices, but it was originally a Farm Security Administration photograph. This woman named Marion Walcott took pictures of people during the 1930s, workers during the 1930s. And White obviously saw this picture and wanted to recreate this man. And the fact that this man is such a central figure in this picture, I mean, your eye is immediately drawn to him. And, I mean, it seems to me to ask the question, you know, what is he doing there? He looks different from the others. He looks very comfortable in his own skin. He obviously is a worker. His face gives off no sign. I feel as though he has almost a kind of a neutral look on his face. Okay, so then when White does the Harvest Talk, he makes the man a little younger. But this is the same, this is modeled on that figure. And so in this picture, I mean, I guess I'm just going to repeat myself. I think this is, you know, to signal something about the strength of the man. The other thing about this picture is that the men are not speaking to each other. And so if you look at this picture long enough, you have to say, is there any sound in this picture? They're not talking. But I feel as though there's at least two sounds that the picture represents. The man is scraping this side, and there's a storm in the background. So like the arm, you know, these are, you know, signals of something. Is this, again, a signal of a kind of fierce determination to fight against something, to struggle? That's as close as I can come.
And it seems that the people are related. I mean, the images are close. They are brothers, or they have the same family.
Yes.
Because, you know, they have the same nose and mouth.
But it's called Harvest Talk. And they're not talking. So, you know, it makes you want to read that picture and to read that storm and that scythe, you know, which might look like a, I don't know, arm and sickle. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
I'm not that close to the sickle. Like, I don't even know how to use a sickle. I haven't seen a sickle. And so I'm trying to figure out, as a 22-year-old, how do I take this message and somehow plant my feet on it as a foundation to move forward?
Well, first of all, you need to know this history. You need to know the history. You need to know the art. You need to be familiar with a history, for example, of the Civil Rights Congress. I mean, you can't do anything with it if you don't know it. And this is not a readily available history. It's not taught in very many, certainly not in very many high school or even college classes, because we have demonized the left and the Communist Party so much that you can't even say anything about them without, you know, someone saying, how dare you even utter the words? And even as I was saying the word Communist Party, I could feel myself saying, oh, I hope nobody's getting scared, you know. So, you know, it's simply to open yourself up to a history that is not readily available, I think is one thing. And I think that there are people doing things that actually do reflect this tradition. I'm thinking of the protesters in Ferguson. I think that there's a real representation of that kind of radical spirit. Thank you for that question. Thank you. Yes.
I'm probably totally way off on this, but I was wondering if the sickle or the scythe, whichever, and the hammers, the glorification of the worker was mm-hmm. part of a subtle communist type of theme.
Not so subtle.
Yeah, maybe, but I wasn't sure I was right. But if that is the case, you're right, it's not
right.
subtle.
And I don't want to say that his focus on the worker was simply a reflection of his being aligned with the left. Okay. White was focused on the worker when he was 16. He grew up in Chicago in a poor family. He was a child of a single mother and was very, very poor. Fortunately, he grew up in the 1930s, where he eventually ended up on the WPA. And it was probably on the WPA that he became radicalized. So there was a kind of grand confluence of events and influences in his life. He grew up in Chicago, where the Communist Party was very much a central part of African-American life in the 1930s. In fact, some of them used to say that when there was an eviction, people would say, go get the Reds, you know, who would, you know, fight against that eviction. So he grows up in a kind of, you know, spirit of radicalism in Chicago. He grows up in a black community that eventually established the Southside Community Arts Center, which was also a kind of progressive group. And then he was close to all of these communist institutions or left institutions. All of that, I think, fed into his focus on the worker.
Okay, and I just wonder, with the storm coming and the harvest is ready, clearly, and they're holding this, it looks like there's trouble, but for us to survive, this is the direction mm-hmm. in which we need to go, to proceed.
Nice reading. So. I'll take one or two more. Yes?
Could you tell me, or us, any sort of backstories on Richard Hofstadter and also Thomas Hart Benton and their relationship with Charles White?
Well, I can tell you one thing about Thomas Hart Benton, and I didn't bring the picture, and I should have. Thomas Hart Benton did an illustration of a black soldier, and I think it must have been 1940, 41. And I think it may be called Negro Soldier. And then Charles White did a picture that looks as though it was a reaction to that picture. And if you put the two of them side by side, you see Thomas Hart Benton's caricature of black people, the big lips, the, you know, kind of stupid look. And White takes that same Negro Soldier from 1940 and makes him elegant, elegiac, strong, and does the beautiful features that he does on all of his pictures of black people. Did they know each other? I don't know. But I do know that those two are like parallel representations of the black soldier, and that you can see that Benton was far behind White in a dignified picture of a black soldier. Yes. There was somebody back there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'm still reflecting on this picture that you have up here. And what I like, and remind me your name again. What Claire brought up, I'm resonating with too, but I want to expand upon it. So I like this kind of hammer and sickle language. I mean, it, certainly the communist overtones there, but I think it points to something much deeper there. And I see the harvest is ready in line with, you talked in some of his other works, like this Old Testament prophet figure. Again, this kind of eschatological language, like something's happening. And I think the storm is further showing like the urgency of that as well. And like revolution has happened and it's here, I think is maybe one way of interpreting this piece here.
So. Oh, thank you for that. Yeah. I love these collective interpretations, since then I can go back and refurbish this chapter. Okay. There was one there, yeah.
I really loved your focus on the various artworks. I wonder, as an English professor, if you would comment on what literary parallels that you see to Charles White during this same time period.
Oh, what a great question, because that's my book. There's only one visual artist in the book, and partly that's because I'm not an art historian or an art critic, but White fits into this Black Popular Front collective. Everybody else in the book is a writer. The first one is Lloyd Brown. He's the only open communist in the book, so I can actually call him a communist because he was officially and publicly one. And then the other writers are Alice Childress, Gwendolyn Brooks, there's a little bit about Lorraine Hansberry, Frank London Brown, and Julian Mayfield. And the thing that ties them all together and really ties them around Charles White, not only did they all know each other and they all worked in these same kind of groups, they were in the Sojourners for Truth and Justice, they were all in the Committee for the Negro in the Arts, they were all supportive of the Civil Rights Congress, and in fact, Alice Childress, who was mainly a playwright, she and Langston Hughes put on their plays at the Club Baron, a left-wing playhouse, to raise money for the Civil Rights Congress, a left-wing political group. And so you had this, you know, the left-wing artist, the left-wing theater, and the left-wing political organization all working hand in hand. And that's what I was trying to create in this book, a sense of how this interaction was kind of mutually supportive. The writers, let me just give you one or two examples. When Childress's first play is published in 1951, it's called Go Through the Trees, and it is about South African apartheid and Jim Crow in America. That's almost a signature, again, that's a writerly signature of the left, to know about South African apartheid, which in the 40s and 50s, that was not common parlance in the United States. But she's drawing that comparison because that's the way leftists internationalized Black struggle. Lloyd Brown's chapter is mainly about one of his essays and his novel, and one of the things that he does in the novel is they actually have portraits of Black communists in the novel, and they're not being disparaged or demonized. They simply are people who work in the Communist Party. They're organizers. And then one last example is Julian Mayfield. Mayfield is the epilogue of the book. Mayfield joined the Communist Party around 1956 when everybody else was leaving, and he said that he joined it because it was the most powerful anti-racist organization that he could join, and so he joined. And he left several years later, maybe around 1959, and he left because he had real ideological differences with the party. But in his novel that he published in 1960 called The Grand Parade, he shows at the very end of the book, there's a big integration protest. They're protesting the integration of the public schools. And he's standing there and he's looking at this crowd that kind of only halfway knows how to form a protest. And he thinks to himself, where are the communists when you need them? And it's just a beautiful ending because so many of these writers and artists did kind of move out of the political left and into the civil rights movement. And they took a lot of their strength and their knowledge and skill and organizing ability into the civil rights movement. You know that two of Martin Luther King's most trusted advisors were ex-communists Jack O'Dell and Stanley Levinson. So there was this kind of movement right over to another, you know, form of political activity. And had it not been for the Cold War and the demonizing of communists, they might have had more influence on that movement. But all of the writers in my book all take on themes and issues and narratives that moved against and tried to interrogate the integrationist conservatism of the 50s. They simply didn't buy the story of integration. For them, the civil rights movement was about protest against economic and political injustice. If integration happened in the meantime, that was fine, but it was not the direct goal of people who were more radical. And so you see that reflected in their work. They take on radical themes in their work, and their work moves towards more radical conclusions, like white. Thank you.